Hello to my lovely listeners, and just before we start this episode on Transgender Day of Visibility featuring Rico, I just wanted to remind you about the Queer Student Awards, a new celebration that's been launched to recognise queer student talent and their allies in the UK. Nominations are now open and will close on the 14th of May 2021. You can find out more at thequeerstudentawards.co.uk and also find us on Instagram at thequeerstudentawards.
I probably thought I was bi. I didn't really, or maybe like gay. I didn't really think I was trans then. I didn't think I'd been realized or acknowledged or processed the fact that I was trans then. But I moved to a new company and they had very stylized ideas about what the male and female employees should look like at work. And there was me with my sort of mass presenting, occasionally hairy legs and just massive afro, and I did not fit into that environment at all.
When it comes to your career, there really is no one formula for success. And if someone had asked me 20 years ago what career I would be working in today, I doubt I would have said employer branding, a career that didn't even exist at the time. Some of the best stories I've ever heard didn't follow a plan. They simply embraced the journey. And that's why I've created this podcast, to share the many career stories that have shaped the people behind them, and to encourage future generations to trust more in the process instead of stressing over getting it right the first time. I'm Steve, and welcome to the My Career Story podcast. Welcome back to the My Career Story podcast with me, your host, Steve Keith. And this week's guest is Rico Jacob Chase. Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate you inviting me onto this podcast, and more importantly, for even creating it. I feel like that's a massive win that you kind of recognise the fact that people's career stories can make an impact. So I appreciate you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I'm really grateful for that. So Rico first came to my attention last year. I saw you taking part in a webinar that was being hosted by Mermaids at the time. So a little introduction to you. So you've provided live updates at the London Black Lives Matter protests, along with revealing some of the whitewashed Black history. Also for Rainbow Films, you volunteered to create documentaries on racism and queer rights as a spokesperson and part of the film crew. The last documentary, Pride and Protest, won official selection 2020 at the BFI Flair Film Festival. You've also spoken on the NHS King's Cross Hospital panels and Northeast A&E doctors on LGBTQI plus healthcare, and on a similar subject at the Mayor of London's roundtable think tanks. Now, as a newly appointed board member of Transactual UK, you're continuing to strive to change UK legislation for non-binary equality, hate crime, and raising the Black queer intersectionality question, something that I saw on a webinar for International Women's Day, actually on Monday, in all forums with speeches at Cumbria Pride. Really? Cumbria? That's where I am right now. London Trans Pride, quoted in Forbes and Department of Transport conferences, as a columnist at, is that Wadzira? He continues to speak out about the complexities of sexuality, gender and racial perceptions. He's recently launched Against Racism, a 9-part show exploring the various forms of racism and how we collectively make a difference. Rico is a very vocal activist, fighting avidly for the rights of LGBTQIA plus people and Black people. So much there. So where should we start? What is your career story?
I guess for most people that I actually encounter who are go-getters and hard workers, it comes from a time of adversity and a time of turmoil. Mm-hmm. I feel as if unless you've been through it and you survived it, it's once you've come out of a war, feel like something which feels like a war zone, you've kind of just become yourself. So for me, I used to work in the financial sector. I was doing well in my career. I was promoted once a year for 4 years. I literally did not leave that building. I was just constantly working. And I think because in the back of my head, because I realized that I was queer, but I couldn't really come to terms with it. And I knew that I necessarily, if I wanted to have a family, my family would be probably non-conventional, and therefore I probably needed to sort of cash on hand in order to finance that. Mm-hmm. So I was hustling hard, and I at the time I probably thought I was bi. I didn't really, or maybe like gay. I didn't really think I was trans then. I didn't think I didn't realize or acknowledge or process the fact that I was trans then. But I moved to a new company, and they had very stylized ideas about what the male and female employees should look like at work. And there was me with my sort of mass presenting, occasionally hairy legs and just massive afro, and I did not fit into that environment at all. I had a breakup with my girlfriend at the time, so I just got really, really depressed. My mum was unwell. It was just like a lot of things happening at the same time, and I was just so over it. I was just so over it. I think a lot of people during the pandemic can probably relate with you just at the end of your tether on an average day. Because I wasn't my usual bubbly self, they took that personally. I ended up being bullied. So I had people laughing at me, swearing at me. My hands would actually shake whilst I was working. And because they couldn't fire me because of my my track record, my work was still perfect, they had to sort of distract me while I was working. So it was like just my peripheral vision was just constantly stuff happening. And then I resigned / got fired. And I was just like, in my exit interview, I basically said, I'll put it down. I said, I was being bullied. That's the reason my performance is dropped. And they said, well, you haven't reported it. I said, yeah, I didn't report it because I didn't want to be a snitch. And they're like, that doesn't count. I was just like, okay, cool. So I was just like, fine. I'll just resign then. So yeah. But the weirdest thing is that my anxiety was sort of peaking. Like I found myself having like slight tinnitus, like people talking on the train were slightly problematic. It would like irritate me more. Mm-hmm. So the warning signs were there, and my eating wasn't really, I wasn't really eating well. So I'm stressed, I don't really eat that well. And I was just tired because I was doing a professional qualification whilst I was working. So I was sleeping about 6 hours a night, just worn down. And then I went home, had a nap, boom, hour later, had PTSD, just like that. And people don't realize how fragile your mental health is. I probably had like the occasional workplace related depression previously, but nothing relatively seriously. Mm-hmm. But my mum came into my room to congratulate me from leaving that hellhole. And I had a massive panic attack. It was like my entire body would shake with convulsions every single time someone came near me. So for the first 8 months after PTSD, no one could touch me. No one could come near me. That's why I love hugs now. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna hug you. Because I just missed it. It's crazy what you miss. I remember about 9 months after I went outside, I could go outside, but I'd have to like drink to tame the anxiety. So if you see a lot of people who are like drunks, don't think they're just drunks. They probably have some sort of mental health condition. And realistically, alcohol is a very, very easy way of dealing with it because it goes away instantly. Therapy takes months. Alcohol takes like a couple of seconds to kick in.
Yeah.
So it's important really not to judge. I remember the first time I went outside and I felt the rain on my face after like 10 months. And I was just like, oh my God, like it just felt beautiful. I used to hate the rain. Now I love the rain because it just feels really, really special. For the first couple of months, about 5-6 months, I was in denial about it. I was like, it'll go away if I ignore it. It doesn't go away if you ignore it. It's something which is now part of you. You can't ignore your own brain. Effectively what PTSD is like the animalistic, the ancient part of your brain that's no longer useful is now in hyperdrive. So when someone comes up to you and says boo and you flinch, that's not a cognitive decision. PTSD is when your body is deciding that in order to protect you, it now needs to react to effectively everything in your environment. And the old part of your brain, it was useful when we were running around with tigers and lions, but it's not really useful in the modern world. So effectively, if you go to speak to a therapist, CBT is very, very good. GP will probably give you medication to sort of, even if you feel a bit, there's no shame apart for getting help. Like the number of people that I've encountered doing public speaking that have had PTSD or some form of mental health issue, literally, I think majority of people do actually have it. They just don't talk about it because it's quote-unquote, it's taboo. That's why I'm kind of glad about the pandemic and everyone talking about mental health openly, because it is really, really important that people do take care of themselves. But yeah, meditation is a massive win. If you think about it, so when you're sleeping, your brain is taking away the thoughts that you no longer need. It's doing spring cleaning. When you're out and about for the day, your brain's obviously operating because you're doing things. Meditation is probably the only thing about your brain, it doesn't stop for your entire lifetime. So you have to give it moments to just rest and mm-hmm. just to clear your mind. Meditation from, I mean, I went from not really being particularly spiritual to like meditating daily. So mm-hmm. it really, really does help. It doesn't really kick in like after a week. You have to sort of do it continuously, prolonged, and eventually start seeing the results. So don't expect to be Yoda after day one, but it does help.
I was just going to say about that actually, because I've tried to adopt some meditative practices into kind of my daily routine, and I'm getting there, but it does take time. So I'm imagining, having heard what you've just said, that when your brain is in a constant state of being triggered, to going all the way to when the point of meditation is that you're mindful in the moment and you're focusing on your breathing, that is going to be one big journey to go through.
It took a long time and it was incredibly irritating. Like with PTSD, insidious thoughts. So it's really, really important to recognize the fact that your body, obviously, is your vessel, your mind is all those annoying thoughts that sometimes are right, sometimes are wrong, and your soul is separate. So if your mind says something like, push that person in front of a train, and you're like, whoa, what is that? Or like, click the knife. Like stuff like that. It's just like, you just like, what the hell's going on? That's your mind doing things. You are not your mind. You have to kind of have that sort of separation. So yeah, it's just the acknowledgement that those two are separate. So you're not responsible for your mind, but you're responsible from not acting on it. That's the distinction. So if your mind says you're really, really crap at public speaking, then you just say, no, we're not. Like, we've done quite a few of these. We're okay. We've got some good feedback. You talk to your mind like it's that annoying best friend that keeps sending you messages throughout the day. Every day. So you just need to just calm him down, basically, or calm them down. So yeah, it's something which I think most people do deal with. And ironically, Buddhist meditation, Hindus meditate as well. A lot of these really, really ancient societies had meditation instilled in their values. You think even Christianity, like doing prayers is being thankful. Being thankful for something is actually a form of meditation. Like, what am I grateful for? What am I grateful for today? Because if you have depression, you're living too far in the past. If you have anxiety, you're living too far in the future. What's actually happening day or today is today. So some people say depression is punishing yourself today for what happened in the past, and anxiety is punishing yourself for what potentially may happen in the future. It's just not... it doesn't exist. It's gone, or it's going to happen. It isn't a reality yet. And having that confidence to just live in today's norm is very, very relaxing and very, very beneficial, because if you're thinking about what's going to happen in 3 days, you're not doing what you should be doing today. So yeah, it took a while. It took me years. CBT, behavioral therapy.
Yeah.
Effectively just a quick crash course on that, but obviously if you do need it, go get the professional help. Waiting list for CBT on NHS is 3 months. So I was in the position where I couldn't take public transport. I couldn't read and write in public at all. So if you have crazy anxiety, you can't really eat food because you're looking down at the plate, you can't see people around you. So I'll be like, I can just about eat. And it was 3 months waiting list, which is nuts. I don't understand why mental health is so underfunded in the NHS. My therapists are amazing though. I did love them. They were so kind. But yeah, when I first started therapy, I couldn't write my name on the application, because you know when you have crazy, you're nervous about something and your adrenaline is kicking in, your vision gets a little bit blurred, and then your heart rate goes up, and then potentially your hands will start shaking. That's adrenaline. So adrenaline effectively takes blood away from parts of your body that you don't really need, and it's a flight or flight mechanism. So I was constantly living in the twilight zone of flight or flight mechanisms. So when your eyes get blurry, when you're nervous, it's because your body is taking blood from parts of your body that aren't really necessary and just focusing purely on your motor skills to just run. So I'm trying to read a document, my body wants to have a run and it's just not helpful. But you know, at the end of my therapy, I signed my name on the form, and my therapist was like, you wrote it? And I was like, I wrote it. And they were like, I wrote it. But yeah, but this started about 3 years ago, so I've had about a year of grace and just normalcy. But the way that CBT effectively works is you have to assess, like, okay, what the situation is, very, very specifically. So for me, okay, if I go to a club or a bar, I feel as if I'm going to be attacked in my periphery by literally Tom, Dick and Harry, because anything on my periphery is just like an instant alarm. And that trigger is precisely related to people walking past me on the trading floor, laughing at me and sort of swearing at me. It's like when you have a soldier in World War II, if they have a, if they hear something which sounds like the helicopter's wings, like a fan, say for example, soldiers have problems with fans because that triggers them. It's exactly the same thing. Something which is similar to, or sounds a bit like, is enough to trigger you, and then you feel as if you're just back in that original moment. That's what PTSD is like.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just a case of you just keep going to different situations where you're going to encounter those instances that trigger you, and say, okay, 80%, I feel as if 80% chance of me getting attacked or assaulted in that position, go there, all right, nothing happened. So now I think my chances of being attacked or assaulted is at 60%, so it's slightly lower. And you have to write that down, because the way that your brain works is that especially when you're like learning new things, you're studying, you're meant to like say things, read things, talk about things, like, because your brain stores these different parts of information from different parts. Mm-hmm. So if you want to prove something to yourself, you have to write it down, you have to say it out loud. And that's how CBT works. So I started off just going to bars and limiting myself to 3 pints. And I started going to art galleries, and I started going to different places where I would pretty much be triggered, or can I read a book on the bus? I think I spent about a month just sitting on buses, just reading, just practicing, just going through it. Just like, if I was going, I got a job as a bartender. Mm-hmm. And I used to read on the way to my bartender job. I used to sit in the coat check in that club, like reading, because people would keep walking past me. And that was good practice for me, because it's just like, I have to be able to read amongst people. And yeah, so that kind of brings us up to, I think, like last year before quarantine. And then I started my own videography business. So because reading and writing was still a bit too much, I realized that I could use a camera. So I was part of a documentary for Rainbow Films, and it was like a training company. So they taught me how to use camera during trying to film the documentary Pride and Protest. And that went on to like go to the BFI, and I was like a junior cameraman on that. And then towards the end of it, they're like, come on, Rico, go tell your story on the documentary. So towards the end of that documentary, I actually talk about like PTSD, etc. And they 100% accepted me as a trans guy, so they kind of respected my pronouns. The manager of that project let me interview people like Lady Phil and Aaron McCarthy, and that was really, really important, because it meant that I could see people who'd been through adversity and come out the other end and they're just hustlers. And it kind of confirmed the fact that it was possible if I just keep pushing through it. So yeah, no, I started my own videography business towards the end, the beginning of last year. And I did some promotional videos for like football, for like an upcoming footballer. Did some work for Verona Rose, which is like in comedy. And over threat last year, yeah, I did some editing, but I did directed and produced a corporate film for the insurance industry a couple of months ago. So you kind of just work out what you're good at and what you are able to do and just go from there. It's basically just been hustling.
Yeah. It sounds like you've gone through a really interesting process there of continually assessing your surroundings and celebrating successes and being able to identify spaces that you're comfortable in and spaces that you're not comfortable in, and then being recognized as somebody who is potentially good at doing something and being given that opportunity. And I can imagine, and tell me if I'm wrong, that maybe when you're working in videography and you're behind a camera filming people, that is a very good way to focus your attention as well.
Yeah, it is. I found, you know, when people were in meetings and they fiddle with something.
Yeah. Sometimes I'm doing it right now under the table. I've got a pen in the hand that I'm fiddling with.
No, because it's just a thing. Sometimes it's just people just prefer to have something in their hands. And yeah, that is just that it's an outlet for anxiety. There's nothing wrong with it. But yeah, no, when I was, when I did have PTSD, I found that if I was walking with someone, it was easier because I could sort of focus my attention on them, or I could have a conversation with them. When you're traveling by yourself, there's nothing that you can really focus on. But yeah, videography was quite good because then you're just focusing on your camera. But it's good practice being in like public settings, because my anxiety was just about public settings. So I just found myself on sets with hundreds of people. I found myself, I filmed at Black Lives Matter protest. I did a live stream at Black Lives Matter protest, and that was a bit challenging because you have to talk, you have to keep the dialogue going while people are walking past you all the time. And my triggers, people walking past me, so that I did it. But before I got there, I was just like, what on earth have you put yourself up to, Rico? Yeah.
But sometimes when you put yourself in those situations, for anybody, I think, and I think that's kind of a part of personal growth, and it's something that I've heard time and time again from people's career stories, is that when they've taken a risk or when they've gone, I really don't know whether I can do this, but I'm going to try it. Yeah. That's where sometimes some magic starts to happen and a new direction in your career can potentially come about. Tell us a little bit more about the piece around Black Lives Matters, and because you've got a piece in here about your show that's exploring various different forms of racism as well. Are you happy to share any of your experiences of racism?
The thing is with me is that I'm in a privileged position because my skin is fairly fair. Plus, I have this British accent. So when it comes to my, say, for example, even my own siblings, are darker than I am. If you see my siblings and you see I'm black, a lot of people think I'm mixed race or Hispanic. I don't know where Hispanic came from, but cool, I get that a lot. I found that because my parents were, they hustled incredibly hard and they put me through good schools and they made sure that I had a decent education. Some doors have opened to me. So even if I did encounter the occasional instance, which I thought was a bit passive aggressive, I don't remember what the word is, microaggressions, which may have been a microaggression, it wasn't detrimental to my career or my progression. I thought as if enough people of color had walked before me for it to not be a problem. The point where I did think it started playing a factor is, say, for example, There will be one role in finance that comes up, and there will be about 15 people internally that have worked together throughout that year who are going to be applying for that one position. So it's pretty darn freaking cutthroat. And you also know there's also external candidates, so you have to be better than all the external candidates and as well as everyone else. So there was some prejudice in the sense where someone genuinely did come up to me and say, I'm a white guy and I'm never going to get a job here because everyone on the trading floor is really white and you're probably going to get it because you're black. And I was just like, no, it's because I'm qualified out of my ass. Like, I did the hard work. Like, I've done more years than you, mate. That's the reason why. So there's moments like that where it becomes a bit frustrating. In the trading floor where I did get a little bit of bullying, there probably was about 4 or 5 black people on that floor. So when I first started working there, someone came up to me and said, Wagwan. And I was just like, Wagwan, what do you mean by that? Like, I said, that's a bit racist. And just the person from Hong Kong was like, no, it's not. I was like, yes, it is. Because Patois and broken tongue is not spoken by all people in Jamaica. It's like colloquial speak. Most people in Jamaica don't actually speak Patois. If you speak Patois in school, they suspend you. It's not a wide stream, and that's us. But try explain that without someone thinking that you're just, you know, being that angry, quote unquote, angry black woman, because I looked like a woman then. So there have been moments where I felt a bit. Also, if you think about overall institutions, your average bus journey in comparison to what it's like at work, and it's not the same. It really isn't the same. It gets to the point where companies probably have around about a 2% or say 10% diversity higher, and they're patting themselves on the back. It's just like, is that representative of the population outside? If the answer is no, then this obviously is a form of white supremacy. And I understand that if you try to find someone who's POC, who's 50 to get here, okay, I take your point, but not for the younger generation. So what I definitely saw in companies, the interns would all be black, but the interns in the high-flying cooler parts of the office wouldn't be black. So people in accountancy or finance or operations or tax would be black, but then people in the jobs that were really, really going for would mostly be white. And then it helps them get their diversity hires up because it means that the ratio for the company looked good, but interns only stay for a year and then they get fired because it's just there for work experience, or they're getting paid like about 20K or something stupid like that. So I think I have seen institutionalized racism, but I wouldn't say to the extent in which it was discussed in the radio shows that I produced and hosted. That's when that really opened my eyes because of the schools I've gone to, because of the people I've associated with, you don't really see racism, or you're not really consciously aware what it's like for how, quote unquote, the other half live. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing more eye-opening than being in a disability assessment. He was like, I never thought I'd be in this room. And you're like, oh my God, like the people here. There's one woman, her hands were shaking as she was like walking along. She could barely walk and she dropped her stick. And I was just like, is anyone going to pick that up? So I walked across the room to pick it up for her. I was just like, do you really need to assess this person's disabled? Like, they could barely walk. Like, and then disability benefits probably give you around about like 400 a month, which is shocking. Like, I spend that on a weekend holiday or like a weekend trip. It's not the same. Like, it's not the same world. Like, 100% the same world. And because they don't necessarily move in the same circles, the two of them aren't really understanding each other. Like, the conservative, people who vote conservative do not understand what it's like for people who are voting Labour at all. And none of the news publications are actually talking about it effectively, which is problematic. So you just end up thinking that I don't know, that the Guardian understands diversity, but they don't understand diversity because most of the people who are writers at the Guardian, surprise, surprise, are probably white. So it's just like a catch-22 situation. But anyway, so the racism show, it's actually finished now, but it is available on, I think, on SoundCloud. There's like a SoundCloud for Real Rebels Radio. Okay. And yeah, it's available there. But so we covered the LGBT sector, we covered police brutality, stop and search, and we had like the head of the Black Police Association came along, Patrick Vernon, Lady Phil came along, Councillor Carol Williams. Like, we got some really, really good lineup. And some of my friends who are in activism came along, like Baby Blue, founder Justice for Black Lives, and throughout the Black Lives Matter process, you could find them anywhere, like in any big square with a megaphone, speaking to thousands of people, just talking about racism. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and then I had I brought some trans and non-binary people along who were activists to sort of speak alongside. So there was intergenerational discussions as well. Like, one of the eye-opening moments for me was when I was talking to Patrick Vernon about, it was Stafford Scott. I was talking to Stafford Scott about the police. And I said, what if you have like Black people in the police forces? Wouldn't that sort of slowly help to make them less institutionally racist? And he said, no. I was just like, why? He says, well, once you're in the police, you're blue. And that's it. You have to show your allegiance to the people that have got your back, because if you're going out to answer a call and the perpetrator in there probably has a gun or knife, you need to trust the people around you have got your back. So you're not Black, you're blue. And the inherent ideal of the police was effectively founded just to preserve assets. The police in the US was actually founded, I think, the same year that slavery was abolished.
Mm-hmm.
It's effectively just to make sure that the rich people's assets are preserved. That's not to say that I haven't encountered police officers that I held in high regard, and some of them are white, but if the overall institution or the creation of the organization was for post-colonialist or racist reasons, then it means that the actual institution is not going to serve its purpose. What we want is an institution that can identify the reasons why people end up in a sort of perpetual cycle of crime and fix it. And that's going to be community groups.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say that I'm 100% abolitionist in the sense I think we just shouldn't have a police force at all. I think that, you know, if my phone gets stolen, I want to call someone. but I do think that we probably, well, the powers that be that created it for the wrong reasons, and that should be acknowledged. But, you know, there's murders left, right, and centre, so you probably need a little bit of police.
Yeah. It's an interesting piece with the police there, and what you're speaking to there, kind of the, so I do some work with a charity called Police Now in terms of recruiting graduates, and their mission is around that diversity piece of making sure that the police force, the diversity of the police force reflects the communities that it's serving, to help to start to tackle, as you're saying, those root causes that are leading to problems further down the track, and nipping things. Well, not that you can probably nip a lot of the big problems in society in the bud, but that you can start to make small incremental changes so that one day you don't have the end point, because these problems don't happen in the first place. And I think my personal take on activism, because you mentioned that a couple of times there, is that that is one of the roles of activism. I see it with a lot of the young people that I speak to. In fact, I was speaking to a group of year nines last week, and one of them said that they wanted to be an activist when they grow up, and that was where their career path was taking them. What would be your take on that if somebody had said that to you? Because I really struggled to kind of give them an answer as to whether or not that was actually a career. Because in my head, I was thinking it's not really a career. It's not something that you get paid for. It's not something that you work towards a promotion within. It is a platform, but yeah, the two aren't the same thing.
I guess it would depend on which protective characteristics that individual is part of. So say for example they were part of the LGBT community, they probably could get a job in Stonewall or LGBT Consortium, and those people in a way are professional activists.
That's a good take.
So the remit is there, but I wouldn't expect to be buying a flat in Zone 1 anytime soon, let's put it that way. You are doing it because you're passionate about it. And I am getting to the stage now where I can probably get paid for doing a public speaking gig. But sometimes that someone will reach out to me and it's a school or it's a charity. And I think, you know what, I know that there's probably non-binary or trans people in that organization that are too scared to actually speak out and say it effectively. So bringing someone such as me in to just say it the way it is so easy, significantly easier for them. So some of the stuff I do get paid for, but I probably net it out nicely with the stuff I don't get paid for. Because in my head, what happened to me should never happen again. And when I was out and about in sort of Soho, you know, sort of hanging out on my various benders, you do speak to a lot of people, and the number of people that you encounter who have mental health issues is shocking. And a lot of them do stem from prejudice. I think, can you imagine trying to be a sort of trans woman walking through the streets of London, how anxiety inducing that must be? You have to sort of pimp yourself out just to go outside, and that's what's happening. People have to pimp themselves out to go to the supermarket. The thing with me is that women wearing trousers is not problematic. So if someone does clock or pick up on the occasional feminine mannerisms, I'm not going to get assaulted. I might get some questions raised. I may get the occasional inappropriate remark from a group of lads, but my day-to-day potential of being assaulted is not the same as trans women. So like, it's nuts, it's crazy out there. Sorry, I didn't quite remember your question. That's why I said you need questions.
No, it's great. We were talking about activism and whether or not activism. It's a career.
There is potential there, but I wouldn't necessarily say you're going into it because you, it's a sort of, it's a sustained income. And a lot of the stuff that I currently work on is project-based, and then I have to sort of pitch a grant funder to give cash for a specific project, and then I'll probably get paid out of that. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, you're not really supposed to be earning a living salary off the back of activism, because the money's supposed to be going to the people who are actually making the difference as opposed to you. Because if you're earning a cushy salary on it, it means that it's not going to the people it's actually supposed to be benefiting. That's one of my bugbears about charities. I think something like 40% of the money that gets donated to charities actually ends up with the people it's supposed to help out, and that's because people are being paid UK salaries and it's supposed to be going to help feed people in Africa. Statistics like that really do bother me. Say for example, some legal work. So I've done some consultancy work for the Department of Transport. I did some consultancy work for the NHS as well. I did some for insurance industry recently. I probably would get paid for that, but it's sort of hit and miss, and you have to create the reputation for yourself. And the people keep saying to me, oh, it's great that you get all these gigs. I said, yeah, I get these gigs because very few people would feel comfortable being vocal as a trans guy. So I'm in an industry that very few people feel comfortable being in. And because I'm so vocal about who I am, and I quite frankly don't really care what you think, that's why I stay off Twitter, I can just do the work. And I think I've already experienced what the worst is like. I've been there. I know what it's like. I pull myself out of it. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't, if someone does hit me with transphobia, I'll probably say, okay, let's talk about your, these views. Like, where did you get them from? Do you understand history? Do you understand colonialism? Do you understand that trans people always existed? So I did a presentation over LGBT History Month about trans lives in British history. People don't really understand that. They think Poe is sort of infected their poor innocent children. It's just like, no, we've always been around, we're just talking about it more now because we finally got the feminist women's rights back up. We finally managed to tackle racism, and now we're trying to get homophobia and transphobia, everything that's been put in due to white supremacy, we're slowly undoing. So, I mean, if you think about everyone's effectively being raised in a dystopia, 1984 is more real than people realize. I don't think people realize that. If you have an institution where all the books are written by the people who are in positions of power, the education system comes from, signed off by the education minister. So they tell you what you're supposed to be learning. Why is it the fact that Churchill had concentration camps in Kenya in the 1950s is not mentioned? Why is the Black Holocaust, where more people died in the Black Holocaust, when the entirety of the Congo, an entire country, was effectively a working camp, and they were they had like rubber plantations, and if the person working on that plantation didn't meet the quota, King Leopold II was a Portuguese. He was a king, he would actually instruct for the hands and children of that man's kids to be cut off. And then there's this really, really iconic, sorry, I'm tributing him one, there's this really, really iconic photo of this man looking at the hands and feet of his kids, because they're just on the porch in front of him. That was happening in like 1917. So just after the Second World War, that was still happening. So the fact that none of that's actually in the curriculum is shocking. And modern day slavery is still happening. There's still concentration camps in for Muslims in India. It's just, people just don't want to see it, or the UK government doesn't want to talk about it, or they don't want to talk about the fact that they put homophobia or transphobia into most of the legal systems of all these colonialist countries. Like, say, for example, India's 377 laws, homophobic laws, making sodomy illegal, was put in during colonialism. Yes, there probably was a little bit of transphobia before, but they all recognized parts of society. In Temple of Artemis, ancient Mesopotamia, they had non-binary people who were considered worshipped in the service of the gods, because non-binary people were seen to have had both male and female characteristics, attributes. They were considered to have two souls, and therefore they were seen as higher beings than the average person. So how did we go from, oh, these people are awesome, they can run our temples, to like being on the fringes of society, wondering if you're going to be assaulted on a bus? Like, how did that happen? And that's just due to colonialism. Section 28, also as well, massive bugbear. Completely removing the LGBT community from all books, everything. So you've got like generations of doctors and nurses, lawyers, even frontline workers. You can go to your ticket office and they can think you're weird because you're non-binary, because their education system never mentioned non-binary. That's nuts. Yeah. We literally are in a dystopia.
Yeah. It's really interesting what you say. I mean, one of my questions that's leaping into my mind is, you know a lot there that people don't. So how have you got yourself to that point of knowledge? Because that's really powerful that you've got there, like your ability to teach others the things that they don't know. Have you had to do a lot of reading around what you weren't told to get to that point, is basically what I'm asking, I think.
Well, my dad follows racism. Mm-hmm. He does a lot of racism, sort of activism. So I learned a lot of that from him. When it comes to the trans community, oddly enough, just Instagram. People don't really understand the power of Instagram. Like, you get to choose who you want to follow, what you want to absorb, and what you want to read. So the Black Trans Foundation and Black Trans Alliance, Chaka Bars as well, just posts a lot of stuff. There's a lot of people who are getting access to sound information, and they fact check it. And then they create a sort of just squares of information, and
the there's
about 6 or 7 of them, and you just read them, and you think, oh my god, like, did you know that there was a non-binary Egyptian pharaoh? That wasn't mentioned. And I think she had like she was killing it. She was well respected. Her predecessor tried to remove her from record because they didn't really want to have a powerful woman there or a powerful non-binary person there. But throughout all the temples, it was clear that she would go by both male and female pronouns and some of the hieroglyphs, etc. So it's not new, and you've been hustling for a while. I mean, I'm trans, but I think around about more than half of the trans community is non-binary. I'm a minority. Most of my friends are non-binary. They, them pronouns is the future. The future is non-binary. The future isn't orange. I like that one. I made that one up.
Love it. I like that idea of the social, bringing social media and influence and platforms together into an educational way of expressing something or communicating something, because quite rightly, as you were saying, if there is no reference to a community within the texts that have been written in the past, then I suppose that was why I was inquiring kind of how you got your knowledge, because you wouldn't find it in the library. So you haven't gone to the library and sat and looked through all the books, because it's not in the books. So where young people will be going will be on social media and looking for stuff. But what's good with the examples you were citing there as well was that piece around fact checking, because there is obviously a huge piece around fake news and how that could be abused.
I mean, the sources, like there'll be professors in gender studies, gender and sex studies, like have PhDs who have Instagram profiles, and they just keep posting stuff. So if you find one, I think I'll probably just say it here, but this person is just, I'm absolutely in awe. They're in the US, and we get access to their information for free, and it's pretty darn powerful stuff. So I can find it. But the information is available. The thing is, a loco, and they have over 670k followers.
Wow.
Exactly. So they're making moves. They're just sharing information. Mm. Yeah, the invention of the sex binary. The sex history of a biological sex, like they're a professor, and they just keep posting information and spreading the word. So that's probably the reason why. I mean, if I was trying to create the curriculum in the UK, would I really want to put of all the global atrocities that the British Empire has done across the world? I can see why the idea of like, oh yeah, they were savages and we went in and we educated them and made things better with our Christianity and our good moral values and our family structures. It's a great story. And it means that people in the UK don't have to feel bad about the atrocities they've done globally, because they can see us as educating the savages. But that's not really what happened. And yes, it is uncomfortable. And yes, you do need to create a nation of nationalists. You have to have people who have British pride. It was a British action, like we will not be slaves. Like, I just think that's cool, and it's like, oh, this is so ironic because my ancestors were slaves. But yeah, I understand it, but I think it's probably a time to sort of recognize that the aim isn't to make people feel guilty about their ancestors. That's never the point. The point is to have a very, very educated discussion about the current state of play, so you don't start looking at individuals as just the person sitting in front of you in an interview. You start looking at them as an amalgamation of the social economic factors that have led to that person. Like, don't create crazy numerical tests that use big fancy words, because the average POC person doesn't speak English like that, because those are words that you use in upper middle class environments. So if you stick them in a numerical test for a job, we're not gonna have the foggiest idea what you're talking about. Like, the number of conversations I have with my white friends, and I just sit there and I don't know what you just said. And I do speak English, but you just made like a reference there to Monty Python. I don't know what you're talking about.
So you're not missing anything, in my opinion.
But it's just understanding that people have different cultures and different understandings, different values, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's just trying to create a society that's more inclusive. Like if you're hiring someone and you want to hire an entire office that can go and play golf with your buddies, that in its well is a bit of a microaggressive pressure, because having access to a golf course is a point of privilege. So don't expect Black people to know how to play golf, because most of us don't. It's those sort of things. I was in the office once and they were like, "Do you follow the cricket?" I was like, "Follow the cricket? Mate, no, I don't follow the cricket." They're like, "Why?" I'm just like, "Because it's the cricket." Like, that's not what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I was like, "Have you heard Drake's new album?" No, I didn't think so.
I love your use of humor, talking about very serious issues as well. So I appreciate that. Yeah. So to wrap things up with you for this interview. So I've asked questions on the form that I get you all to fill in beforehand. And the three quick fire questions that I've been asking everybody for this season and to try out this new format is, the first one was, if your career story was a book title, what would it be? And you answered, "Be Your Own Sculptor." Now I can kind of see why you would use that title based on what you've been talking about, but is there anything that you would add to that? Why did you go for that?
Be Your Own Sculptor, because if you keep internalizing the perceptions of other people, you are forever going to be at fault. I mean, I remember there was those memes going around about, like, is the dress blue or purple? Like, because it was like a close color and they had like mass perception of people saying, "Oh no, it's blue. Oh no, it's purple." Imagine that as you as a person. You encounter one day to tell you to be purple, and you encounter someone else to tell you to be blue, and you'll forever be between blue and purple, and you end up being indigo.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to recognize that you are your own sculpture. There's no one that can do you better than you. Don't look at Kylie Jenner and, you know, plump your lips up with silicone. Don't install fake breasts and stuff to make you think that you're going to feel better. That's not the way the world works. Like, you have to be at peace internally before you have external changes. And the same thing goes for being as a trans guy. Like, I had to be comfortable with my identity internally before I even started considering doing testosterone, etc., because those decisions are permanent. But you're never going to find happiness by living up to other people's expectations. A number of people kept telling me that it was quite irritating. "Oh, you were so pretty as a girl. Oh, what a waste." It's like, "Oh, do you really have to?" I had someone on the dating app yesterday tell me exactly the same thing. They're like, "Oh, I fancy lesbians, but do you really have to have top surgery?" I'm like, "I'm a trans guy, then yes." Yes, I do. You just have to recognize that everyone has an opinion and everyone thinks that they're entitled to give you their opinion. And it's important to recognize that you have the right to ignore them and just do your own thing. What matters is, are you comfortable in your own company? That is the massive thing, especially if you have depression and anxiety. Can you stand your own brain for about 3 or 4 hours? Can you live with what you've done previously? You're answerable to yourself, not to everyone else. And I think that's really important to make. Mm. And there's this really, really great image of this guy. He's like really got chiseled abs, and underneath him, he's just like this other person, like suddenly like bigger, because it just goes with the image. And he's just there with a chisel. He's literally just chiseling his own body out, because you make yourself. No one else does that for you. So stay true to yourself, effectively.
Yeah, no, I love that. It's a really, really great way of looking at it as well, Rico. So you gave me as well 3 words to describe your career story. Again, I can see kind of some of these coming out, but anything that you want to add? You said that adaptability, perseverance, and self-care. The self-care message was coming through loud and strong right from the out of the gates with this. Perseverance, I can see, I can imagine the things that you've been through involve a level of resilience that is probably above and beyond what a lot of people have experienced in their life, and then having to adapt. But anything that you would add to that?
Yeah, honestly, keep going. I mean, I went through hell, but I keep thinking about those people like on some front line or some war zone, like asylum seekers. I think bloody hell, like I just about survived. I can't possibly see anyone turning away an asylum seeker. Like nuts, it's crazy. Like life is very, very tough, and life is very, very brutal. And I think it's important to recognize that your reality is your reality, and you are entitled to feel sad or happy about your reality, despite whether someone else has done something which is worse. But the important point of recognizing that other people have had it worse is that it means it's possible for you to push through, and that's the sort of distinction. Recognizing that other people have had it worse doesn't mean that you should feel guilty about having your down days. It just it creates an environment where it's where you can recognize that with a couple of months or a couple of years' work that you can get to where you want to be. And I'm not saying my life is perfect. My life is still, there's like, it's still turmoil. I have crazy days, I have bad days. Like, yeah, if things happen, but the point. Important point is that you can be in literal hell. I was in hell and I managed to call myself out of it. But yeah, I know so many people that didn't get out of it. And yeah, I still grieve for them sometimes, to be honest with you. When you go to sort of those trans visuals, those really do get to you, because some of us do get through and some of us don't. But that, I think it's those sort of reasons that it makes it almost imperative that you do keep going with the activism. Yeah, because I think activism, yes, it is a career, but a lot of us are so angry and in so much pain that it's something which we just have to do because we don't necessarily see any other option. If you see your friends falling to mental health issues and just left, right, and center, you have to keep going. But also self-care, because you have to keep yourself in a good place. I have very, very clear boundaries in my day. If I have an emotionally exhausting conversation in the morning, I will potentially ignore people for the rest of the day. So I have like my own bandwidth. Like if I feel as if I'm a little bit too strained, I'm just like, no, I've got to keep myself going for tomorrow. And as much as I love you, I've reached the end of my capacity for today. And I think my friends do the same. So I have about four or five friends that I can message if I'm going through a tough time. If one of them doesn't respond, I don't take it personally because the other two people I'm talking to. But everyone just needs to have their own bandwidth and just their respect. I do find a lot of people who are going through very, very tough times, and they have a really, really bad habit of taking people under their wing and taking care of them. And it's good, but if you can't take care of yourself and you can't feed yourself, then you really shouldn't be taking care of other people. And it's a harsh reality, but it's true. You gotta love yourself before you love anyone else.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Final question for you. What would be the career advice that you would give people listening? If you could think of one thing that would be a nugget for people to take away.
That's weird. That's a tough question. Because I'm currently still having an internal debate between career happiness and income. A lot of people say do what makes you happy and then eventually you can get paid, but that isn't always the case, especially if you're a PhD person. Sometimes you need to get paid, and it is a pandemic. So what I probably would suggest would be do something a bit more prudent and do the jobs that pay you so that you can keep your mental health going, you can have a roof over your head, and you can keep your diet positive. And I would say keep your hobbies on the side. And when you get to the point where your hobbies earn you as much as your salary, or I would say as much as or one and a half the amount of your salary, so you know that it's a stable income, then do a switch. I'm not saying you need to give up your dreams, but I'm not. But it's important to be sort of be realistic about your life. Yeah, I mean, I know some people who have, who are, what is it? Who do work in activism full time, 100%. That is possible. The jobs are there, opportunities are there, but sometimes you have to be able to prove yourself before you even get there. When it comes to videography, so for example, you do a lot of running work, so you have to be like a runner, a very, very junior member on film sets. Because of the pandemic, those opportunities aren't really there yet. So if you weren't in a lockdown, I would say throw your energy into the career and keep going. Because it is a lockdown and things are tough right now and people are getting laid off left, right and center, I would say have a job and then keep your hustle on the side. And the perfect thing about working from home is that your manager doesn't know that you're doing two jobs. He doesn't know. He doesn't need to know. Because you're keeping your performance going on both. He doesn't know. And got the focus idea that you've got two jobs. So you can still do your career as long as you keep your job going. You can write your blog, your racism blog. You can keep your activism going. You can do your editing for your dream film. I mean, no one needs to know. Well, I didn't say that. Didn't hear from me.
No, we didn't hear that, did we? No. We're not going to attribute that back to you. Right, fantastic. Thank you so much for your time, for being so honest and for being so open about the clear challenges that you've had right from the start in your career as well. I really appreciate you taking the time to share this with us.
No, thank you for inviting me, honestly. I love having the opportunity to share these sort of things because I've met people who have, who probably where I was about a year and a half ago. And I just sort of said to them, no, I got through it. It sucks. I hear you. It really sucks, but you can get better. And then they're like, oh, I was just like, yeah, you don't have to live with it forever. You can get it to the point where you can manage it and you can still get on with your life. And I think that's a really, really important distinction. Plus, people who are in the sort of trauma mental health club, I do find have a level of empathy and kindness, which I don't really find in the and others. So, and you become a bit of an empath. You become very, very sensitive to your energy and your environment around you. And that is such a win because when you pick people that you're going to be friends with, your companions, you naturally gravitate to people who have that warmth and that kindness. And that can make your life so much better, especially if you have the self-love and you know that you deserve it. Mm-hmm. Mate, you can find some amazing people. Yeah. So yeah, it does get better.
It does. Thank you to everybody for joining us today, for listening along. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to review. Don't forget to share. That's the whole point of this podcast as well. And we'll be back next week with another episode. Bye.